Welcome to The Generative Age,
a podcast that explores the rapidly evolving world of generative AI and its impact on education.
Guided by EdTech director, author, and NYSCAPE board member, Alana Winnick, we are joined by experts and practitioners in the field who are shaping the discourse of artificial intelligence in the classroom.
Whether you're an educator, administrator, technology leader, or simply interested in the future of education, join us on this journey through The Generative Age, powered by NYSCAPE. In this episode, we'll hear from Microsoft Education's Chief Innovation Officer. But first, I need to tell you about a big development from Google. Ironic, I know. They've released Google Gemini, and there's multiple versions of Gemini: Nano, Pro, and Ultra. Nano can be found in smartwatches and phones. Pro is what powers Bard and is equal to like GPT 3.5. And Ultra, which isn't available yet, but everyone says it's more powerful than GPT-4. The language around these names can be a little bit confusing because you've probably heard of Bard, which is the interface that you communicate with if you use Google. And now Gemini is what powers Bard. So to make it even more confusing, you can use Google Assistant powered by Bard, powered by Gemini. Try saying that 10 times. I know. So you might ask, what's different about this? I know that we've discussed OpenAI's multimodal model, which powers both ChatGPT as well as the Microsoft platforms and supports text, audio, and images as input and output. But what makes this a little bit different is that OpenAI's version converts everything back to text, processes it in text, and then outputs it back in whatever medium you're asking for. Google Gemini is designed to be natively multimodal, which means that it processes it in its native input and native output. The demo that Google released was very, very impressive, almost too impressive, which is why people are questioning the model and its power. If you look at the description of the video, there's a very small line that says, for the purposes of this demo, latency has been reduced and Gemini outputs have been shortened for brevity. This makes it very deceiving because they left out the multiple prompts on how they got to the output. So there was many prompts to get to where they got to, and they made it look like it just happened in the first time. I've included links to both the demo and articles in case you want to go a bit further about that. Although it might not be what we're hoping for, it definitely shows a promising step forward with artificial intelligence. And now let's get to the main event. I'm so excited to share with you my interview with Microsoft Education's Chief Innovation Officer, Michael MJ Jabbour, live at the annual NYSCAPE conference.
We're recording live at NYSCAPE with our first keynote. You did a wonderful job last night. We're so thankful to have you here. Is there anything you want to say before we dive into your background?
Well, firstly, thank you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the opportunity. I had no idea how large this conference was. So it's great to be here. Great to connect with everybody. I know it's somewhat of a challenging age that we're all going through, but I hope that we're going to be able to get through it together.
Last night, you had an incredible keynote, positive feedback here. Everyone loved it. But what I found was really interesting was your background. Talk me through this. So you said you worked in medicine, you have an MBA, and then you were in education. Like, how did that happen?
Yeah, it's somewhat of an unusual story. I have a doctorate in Chinese medicine, but I had mostly an integrative training. And I have been involved in business, technology, and medicine for a long time, decades at this point. About 15 years ago, I took on a role with the New York City Department of Health, looking at tobacco control, chronic disease, emergency management, and various other very interesting divisions at health. Ended up taking on a role in parallel to clinical practice as a chief information officer for the New York City Department of Homeless Services, in parallel the chief technology officer for the Social Services Department, and then just when I was about to leave the city, the CTO for the New York City Public School System.
Yeah, so that I thought was interesting. How did you get into that role?
So I think initially it was just about impact. You know, I love my clinical practice, and I'm able to look someone in the eye and take them from being in a very broken place to being in a place where they are better, In my case, a lot of times that's infertility related. And so helping, you know, a family grow is really meaningful work. And it's something that gives me a lot of life.
Yeah.
But we were able to do in the health department, which was my first kind of introduction to that work. I was brought in initially as a consultant through a program through the CDC to help with the media and the technology elements of it. I was able to make a huge impact at scale through New York City government, and that's how I at least transitioned into that work.
So how do you go from the New York City Department of Education to Microsoft Education's Chief Innovation Officer?
It's a great question. I wish I knew the answer to that. I joined right before the pandemic at the DOE, and we deployed over a million devices to students and had an unbelievable time consolidating their technology, getting our teachers up to speed. So navigating the pandemic was, I think, one of the biggest challenges I had in city government. But we were also able to build some of the largest things of their kind in the world. Whether it's the largest Microsoft Intune instance in the world, largest Google Classroom in the world. And so those scalable, very impactful, I guess, technology ideas, really something that belongs in one of our cloud providers. And when I was looking at the work that Microsoft was doing and the type of scale they were trying to provide to be able to impact billions of children worldwide, conversations were had, and before I knew it, I was there.
Yeah. I mean, as a fellow Microsoft district, I really strongly believe that Microsoft Suite is transforming education. The possibilities are incredible, like all of your accelerators, and I'm not going to say anything about any other providers, but I'm a real big fan of Microsoft.
Thank you, Alana. And yes, there's a lot going on, a lot of super interesting products that not only are there, but are coming out. And you're going to see generative AI start to play a role in our learning accelerators and other tools that we are offering. Getting things right for education takes more time than you want it to.
Yeah.
But we are going to take the time that's required to do it right.
Of course. And that's really important, to do it the right way, not just to do it. All right. So before we start to go into MJ's opinions and beliefs, let's talk a bit about Microsoft. So I know that Microsoft invested a lot of money into OpenAI. So can you talk to us a bit about the relationship between Microsoft and OpenAI?
Sure. Microsoft's mission is to help every person and organization on the planet achieve more. And OpenAI's mission is to ensure that artificial general intelligence benefits humanity. And as we had described last night, three major forms of AI are going to be narrow, general, and super intelligence. And right now we're really focused on making sure that artificial general intelligence is where it needs to be. And what that means for your listeners is that it's going to be an AI that can perform at the level and with the knowledge of a human. And we've supported OpenAI significantly, and we have a great relationship with them. And my hope is that we continue to evolve these products while we continue to evolve our own co-pilots and forms of AI at Microsoft.
Okay, so can you tell us a bit about what's coming with AI in education at Microsoft?
So when we're looking at it from a broadly ecosystem, whether it's a large K-12 district or a higher education organization, we want to make sure that we're providing safe forms of AI, whether it's through Microsoft Copilot or other tools. As you know and mentioned, the learning accelerators are really focused on mostly K-12 and the lower grades, but something I mentioned last night that I'll repeat now is important. A student doesn't know when they're going to be blocked.
Yeah.
Right? So when they don't understand prepositions, they will hide that. If they don't understand quadratics, they can hide that. And teachers don't have infinite patience to sit with them. And I think this is an opportunity for every student to get education in a truly meaningful way, in their language, in their culture, at their level, regardless of what grade they're in. And so you're going to see changes in our product suite to match that. So I'm already seeing some evolution in our learning accelerators to expand what they're offering and how they're offering it. The ability to generate content for teachers and do that safely is something that we're absolutely looking into now. And then the earliest age that we can make being in GPTs available, as well as provide them coaches not just search coach,
yes,
but prompt coaching.
Yeah.
So you'll probably see some things like that come from us.
We are a big fan of search coach in my district.
Excellent.
Like, it is really incredible. We use it down all the way down in the lower grades. It's really great to teach media literacy. So you just talked about safety and security. So I think that that's a really big one. So I'm going to jump a few ahead because this is very important. We are a Microsoft district, and I think that for those of you that are listening, even if you are a Google district but you have a Microsoft domain, you can enable Bing Chat Enterprise in your domain. And we're in New York right now, but we do have listeners from all over. In New York State, we have Ed Law 2D data privacy and security laws. It's only Ed Law 2D compliant for staff members right now. So I do have enabled, I encourage them to use it because of all of these great features here. I put it, linked it for you in the slide deck, but it says searches are not linked to individual user accounts, prompts and responses are not saved, chat data is not used to train the model, and no one at Microsoft can view your data. So I really love that. I'm encouraging all my teachers to use it. There's built-in image generation. It's wonderful, lovely. It's much safer and more secure than anything else that I could tell them to use. When can we expect this to be available for our students?
It's a great question. I can't give you an exact timeline, but we're gonna start with higher ed students first, and that will probably be the beginning of next year. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to see us kind of move down to the earliest possible age in the high school arena, probably where that's
And is it because you're putting like parameters around? Are you doing something special for students?
Yes. We evaluate guardrails. The guardrails can be and should be different. And we're looking at not just those guardrails, but how is it going to be used? And how do we want the tool to work with the student to learn?
What do you think?
I think I had heard recently, and I don't remember where, but it was an excellent explanation that when we're building these tools, we want the cognitive load to be on the student. And AI can sometimes naturally take the cognitive load away.
Right.
And you spoke about this in your conversation around process over product, which I thought was excellent.
Thank you.
And you know, as we're like looking at building the students of the next generation, we want to make sure that these tools are helping them to build their skills and build out their tool chest and be able to really grow how they're able to think about problems and solve problems. And so ensuring that our tooling is doing that is certainly a top priority. Making sure that it's done safely and complying with all appropriate regulations is also critical. Microsoft has a framework or standard called Responsible AI, which is a journey that Satya started in 2016. We talked about that.
Yeah, I had that on my list. So do you want to just touch on that a little bit?
So Responsible AI was a journey started in 2016 with Satya. He wrote an article about this in Slate and has since taken on a life of its own with many companies building out their own Responsible AI framework. And what it basically means is responsible in building and responsible in using. And so when we look at things like fit for purpose or where and how around human oversight, security, privacy, inclusivity, ensuring that we're minimizing stereotyping and bias, those all live in our responsible AI framework. We have multiple teams at Microsoft that focused exclusively on that. Not just the evolution of the framework, but how it's rolled out, how it's implemented, how it manifests in tooling.
That's very good to hear that you guys are putting like an emphasis on these incredibly important things, because I know there's, you know, there's so many tools out there. And when they all came out, I told everyone, like, let's just wait a minute, because this is going to be baked into every single thing we do, and it'll probably be done in a more purposeful way that was much more well thought out. So I'm glad that you guys are thinking about all these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you will see some differentiation between like intuitive AI and generative AI.
For sure.
And so you're going to see different forms of AI used and also expand and grow over time. But you're going to see some forms of generative AI that will be as common as autocomplete and spell check.
Great. That's awesome. And I listened to an interview with Sam Altman, and he was saying that like right now in Gmail, I don't know about in your world yet, but they have the lab where it's built into your email. It will help you write your emails right in Gmail. I don't think it's in Outlook yet. Is that?
So with Copilot, it is.
The Windows 11 Copilot?
So Windows 11 does come with a Copilot. That's correct. But it will be, Microsoft Copilot is a dedicated set of tooling. I'm very similar to Google Duet in terms of the way that it's presented inside of the tools, but the ability to help you draft emails.
So what Sam, so let me rewind. Yeah. So Sam Altman said that right now it can be built right into your email and it can help you write your email. But one day, not too far away, you'll just be able to wake up and open your inbox and every single email will already have a draft that sounds sort of like you. And all you have to do is read the thing, tweak it, and press send. And he was saying it's not too far away.
It's not too far away. And at Ignite, just this past week, in Redmond, we actually announced the Something Like You inside of Outlook, where Copilot will start to learn your approach and be able to formulate emails, not necessarily like a generic AI, but actually the way that you would write something.
At this Ignite thing, what else did I miss? Because I clearly didn't watch it.
Oh, there was a lot.
Okay, because I have been prepping for this, and yeah. I have not really been following the updates. So what did I miss? Like the highlights.
Highlights. Well, we're now making chips.
That's amazing. Microsoft. But that's great. Because there's a shortage.
Yeah, so there are many things that came out. I, in all honesty, I'm still processing myself. I would strongly recommend you watch the two keynotes.
Okay.
If they're online and available
okay.
from Ignite from day one and day two.
Okay.
But many announces around chips and the types of cabling and just what our data center build looks like is gonna be significantly improved and changed. Our ability to use and train AI models on a purpose-built equipment is really where that's going. Secondly, you're going to see major changes in security. The amount of attacks are substantially increasing. Our ability to defend them, because many schools, particularly in education, have anywhere from 50 to 80 tools that they're using for security. That number may sound fabricated, but it's real. And we probably need more like one or two. As we are looking at using things like Security Copilot and other areas to help reduce all the noise to actually find and get to the signal, you saw a variety of announcements at around Copilot, improvements and releases around Copilot, as well as what we call Copilot Studio. So we released the ability to now build your own Copilot.
Right, that's so cool.
So you're going to see a lot of innovation come from the community, and it won't be something that has to be, lightly drafted. You can now architect an enterprise version of a Copilot, which will be an amazing thing to watch.
That's awesome. Do you think one day a teacher will have like their own, like it'll be customized to that teacher and the student could interact with their teacher?
Yeah, I was actually just talking about this in our prompt engineering class about temperature and how you're going to have some creative teachers and some teachers that are less creative.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me because when you're in these programs, you're going to see that teachers, you might have a very creative teacher, but the student might not think that way.
Right.
And so we don't have the need just to have it sound like the teacher,
right.
but to have it enabled so that the student can receive it in their approach.
That's amazing.
So you may have a very like dry teacher, but you may have a student that's very creative and
yeah.
needs it in a creative way.
Yeah. One of my cousins thought she was really bad at math, but she wasn't. It was just the yeah. style of her teacher. She just, it didn't gel with her.
That's
and then
right.
she got a tutor and she was fine.
That's right.
So I think you're right. It is also about the teacher, the student receives the information.
That's right. Yeah. You're going to see that it has an infinite amount of patience. And also there are many studies coming about how it's mimicking empathy and what that might mean for us.
What do you think about that?
So it's a really interesting topic. You know, there was, I mentioned last night in the keynote that there were two studies recently that came out around patients that opted in to get difficult news
yeah.
by a chatbot.
Yeah.
And in the context of that chatbot experience, when they evaluated people, and we're talking about like cancer diagnosis,
yes.
difficult news.
Yes.
And when they evaluated patient perspectives, they found the chatbot over a physician that was rotated on the back end of that
yeah.
to be more empathetic, more useful, mm-hmm. and more human than the physicians. And so I think you're going to see role changes in terms of humans focusing on what they're good at and AI focusing on what it's good at
yeah.
as we start to enter into this Copilot era.
What do you think should not be handed off to an AI?
It's a great question. I think about that all the time.
Yeah. You don't have to have an answer. I'm just...
Yeah. I don't have a lot of great answers for you at this moment because we're still the very, very beginning of this conversation. We're just starting to explore what this really means for us. My sense is that we can't hand off human embrace and being able to be there with someone, to connect with someone. You can write a very empathetic, very connecting note. You can communicate empathetically, but human interactions are still going to require, not just your standard human approach, but I hope that we get in touch more with our abilities, though, and empathy.
So, like, human intelligence, you think, is incredibly important.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, emotional intelligence, human intelligence. I think we're gonna become better at that as a result of this, because we're not using all of our cognitive space to be focused on things that a computer could be able to do very easily.
Yeah, I like that answer. All right, so let's hop out of the Microsoft world and into your personal world.
Sure.
Can you tell us one creative way you use AI personally and one creative way you use it professionally?
Sure. So personally, I find that even though I may have read documents and know them very well, having access to them is really critical for me. So being able to take like 5 documents, turning it into a chatbot, and being able to dialogue with it and ask it complex, sophisticated questions, and tune it to respond appropriately, extremely helpful for me on a personal level. I also think that when I need to draft something or solve a problem that I don't have a good solution for, giving it broad context, meta context, and say, help me. It does an incredible job of giving me a creative scaffolding for thinking about a particular solve. Professionally, writing is a huge part of our job, and being able to draft content faster that is high quality content is critical. So for me, being able to analyze things, to write things at the level that is acceptable in a professional setting is what's most exciting. It's not yet there in every way, but it's getting there very fast. And so I use it frequently for drafting content in that way.
That's awesome. Last night you told us you have multiple children ranging from a very wide age range. I think you said 3 to 17?
Yes, I have a 3-year-old, 10-year-old, 14, and 17.
So that's quite the age difference. So a lot has happened in 17 years. So what was it like raising a child and having a child go through school and learn with technology from your 3-year-old to your 17-year-old, and now with AI?
Yeah, it's a very interesting range. My 17-year-old is using it to prepare for college interviews now, which is amazing. We created a GPT that scours the internet for all of its available admissions information, and he can specify his name, GPA, and SAT score, and it walks him through a customized interview.
That's
45-minute
awesome.
Session that helps him prepare for the college interviews and the interview process, which was great. Helps answer any questions that he has about the university, and helps him to really dialogue and interact with it. I sent it to a friend of mine who's a reviewer, and she said it was amazing, better than she is at this process. My 14-year-old is trying to figure out the most responsible way to use it for essays and then solving other types of problems. When I look at my 10-year-old's math, it's super interesting because even I wasn't trained in math that way.
Right.
So I'm not good at necessarily solving or understanding where his solves may be wrong.
Right.
I took a picture of one of his piece of homework.
With photo
math? With visual GPT.
Oh, cool.
And it even with his not-so-awesome handwriting, it immediately understood what it was, understood which problems were solved correctly, which ones weren't, and then picked out the missing skill that he had.
That's incredible.
That was preventing him from applying it to the other solves.
That's amazing.
And then my 3-year-old is super interesting to watch her because she's all verbal AI. Right, it's either swiping something or it's talking to an Alexa or a Siri. And I've been playing with Pi AI and other types of voice related AI, and she'll be interacting with an AI in a year from now that is more knowledgeable and more eloquent than any human she'll ever meet, And those will be some of the first formative memories that she has around AI and technology in general.
Yeah. And what about the ones in the middle?
So, you know, I think that my 14 and my 17-year-old are going to do their best to move through the system as it is today and use AI to empower them in that process. So they're going to use AI as more of an accelerator and as a tool, which is an excellent use and really where it should be used. I think that my 10-year-old and my 3-year-old are going to find different uses of it. They're also going to demand different things from the system. Keep in mind that they might not go to a doctor unless they can talk to their kids.
Right.
They might not go to a college where they can't talk to their classroom without the teacher or have a virtual TA. And so their expectations are going to mandate different changes in our systems.
Yeah. So that goes to one of the questions I had for you. Like, what do you envision the future? I know we can't really predict it, but what do you hope it's like?
I hope that every student, let me back up for a moment. At the DOE, you're going to see every type of care provided, food, transportation, education, but you're also going to see health and mental health. Because there's so many children in poverty at the DOE. They say that like 73% of our 1.1 million children were in some form of poverty.
Wow.
And so when I was looking during the pandemic, almost half of our kids did not have a device and internet at home when the pandemic first started.
Right.
And that is an unbelievable statistic.
Yes.
And the effort that the DOE went through to deliver those devices was also unbelievable. It was heroic in nature. We had teams working around the clock for months on end to make that happen for them. I think that AI can have the potential to widen the divide.
I was going to ask, that was going to be my follow-up question, so you just hit it. I was going to ask you, how do you feel about this digital divide, digital equity?
Yeah, so we're going to, let's answer both questions in the same way, which is that every student, they deserve their own co-pilot. They deserve their own teacher that has infinite patience and has the ability to match them and meet them at their language level, at their grade level. You know, you may have a kid that's in 11th grade that doesn't have the same reading comprehension as someone that's in 6th or 7th grade. And our system doesn't account for a lot of those competency gaps really well. But a student co-pilot would, to help every person at their level be able to access any type of knowledge. And vice versa, you have folks that are in 5th and 6th grade that can learn content and can excel beyond those that are at high school level.
Right.
So how do we do that? How do we do that without losing our humanity, without losing those social relationships and those connections? It's a very complex topic.
Yeah, we could talk about that for like an hour.
At least.
Yeah.
And I think that that's where we're going to see a lot of our educational tools and capabilities and training go. I think that's what real equity and accessibility is going to look like. It's going to ensure that every person has what they need to be successful.
Okay, speaking of equity, some schools are still blocking it.
Sure.
So what advice would you give to an administrator that's still blocking this today?
You know, when I left the DOE, they had immediately banned the use on the school networks for GPT. I think it was one of the largest bannings of its kind.
Probably. Yeah, it was all over the news.
All over. It was everywhere. But they've since reversed course on that, which is amazing, and I'm super proud of them for doing that. But they took the time to evaluate what appropriate practices meant. They took the time to help ensure teachers understood what this tool is and what it could potentially be. And so, you know, for administrators, I would say learn, get skilled up, understand what this is. It has the potential to do amazing things. It also has the potential to be dangerous, but you should learn what those dangers are. So not hiding from the topic is an important thing to do. My sense here is that there are many areas operationally within the school system, whether it's turning manuals into chatbots, that could significantly relieve burden from staff and relieve burden from teachers to be able to provide education directly to students. And so if teachers can provide reliable lesson plans and rubric and content development and get their presentations done faster, they will be able to spend that time with students.
Yes. And in the U.S. Department of Education report that they came out with, it said 49% of teachers' time was spent directly in front of students.
Yeah.
That means 51% was not with their students.
Yeah.
And they said with the technology that's out right this minute, it could save them 8 hours a week.
Yeah. It's an incredible thing to think about.
Yeah.
And by the way, you're going to see similar statistics in medicine of physicians that can't spend the time with their patients because they're stuck in administrative areas that can easily be done by AI.
Right.
Now, I caution that with saying not everything should be done with AI.
Right.
And part of that journey is at least taking an initial stand on what we aren't going to do with AI to open the door for what we can do.
What can we do?
A lot. Learning accelerators are built as a safe tool already, ready to go.
Yeah.
But they can do lesson plans. They can create these amazing educational examples. You know, I was mentioning about how one higher ed I was at asked me to teach angular momentum with a toilet. And the GPT gave this amazing example of a skier going around the bowl over and over again as it's moving towards the drain, gaining momentum and force. And, you know, there are these amazing explanations and teaching moments that can be delivered through AI. What I'm telling administrators and schools is you don't need to go after these major, large use cases. Find use cases that are small, that are low risk, that are low effort, but have high impact.
Can you give us a couple of examples?
Well, lesson planning is a great example because it's something that the humans have to confirm. It's something that can be generated very easily. On the administrative side, even doing something like drafting a job description is instantaneous. And so you're going to see some of those content generation exercises get really fast. And with Copilot, we're going to see other areas, I think, whether it's generating presentations or analyzing data in Excel, or simply just helping save time when it relates to email and other types of administrative burdens. And you will see more advanced use cases over time evolve. You know, grading is still being determined as to how appropriate is it, when can it be used, what are safe uses of it. So we're still looking at some of those use cases.
Yeah, I agree with that. Because when I was at ISTE, this one vendor said, oh, we can grade all your papers for you. And then I thought about that. That goes back to the question as to when should you pass something to AI and when should you not? I'm still questioning things every day, all the time. I don't know.
But yeah, that's, I think, the difference between a co-pilot and an autopilot.
Yeah.
We're not building an autopilot here. We are building co-pilots. And I think that speaks to the heart of this. The other thing to know that's important for administrators to take in consideration is that while grading is not yet there, there will be many use cases where it will get there.
Right.
Plagiarism detection is something that's widely known.
It should not be used.
Yeah.
You know what's so funny? When I present, I show ways that you can detect AI, and there's manual detection. Like maybe look at the version history, have, you know, focus on the process and check in with students along the way. And then I have another one that's like technology-aided detection, and I go through it. And then at the end, I go, curveball. AI can outsmart AI. Like literally, you could use a second AI and swap the AI content into another AI that replaces it with synonyms, and it goes from 100% to 0% in like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And that's building a culture that you don't want to build. Do you want to build a culture where you're like, gotcha, got, like, that's not the right culture. And then, oh, this is a great one because you talked about it yesterday.
Punishment culture.
Oh, there's a punishment culture, but you talked about it yesterday. You still talked about academic and honesty. So I think that by using detection, that's academic dishonesty. I think we need to focus on academic integrity and academic honesty. And I think academic honesty, which uses a lesson, academic integrity, are the most important things right now, not detection tools and creating this culture of, what did you call it? Punishment?
Punishment first culture. I think there's a lot of gray area on that, and that's where we've got to expand our thinking. Because when it comes down to doing homework or writing a paper or doing a PowerPoint, I hope that it's clear that people should cite their work and make sure that
100%.
It's appropriate. But for the younger generation, it might not be so clear, so I'm not 100% sure, although I would hope so. Whereas if you're going to write a sympathy note for someone because you don't have the words, then you probably wouldn't cite GPT or Copilot. Right now, there are many things that are in the middle. There's a lot of gray area when you're writing letters to coworkers, when you're publishing a policy, when you're using it for different functions in your organization. I think it's important to understand what would your peer expect from you? Would your peer expect you to say, I used Copilot to draft this, or does it matter?
But what if you just use it as a thought partner and the thoughts originate with you and end with you? So what I like to call it is like, I'm like an art curator and there's like a gallery and they perfectly picked out the art pieces. And I'm not really super into art, but a lot of people are. I know Art Basel's coming up soon. Or like the kid-friendly term I use is like a DJ. They're like picking and choosing their own beats and like curating their own song. I think for me, I think of AI as like, the thought should always start with you as a user. You should use it to create ideas, but if the final product is reflective of your own thoughts, your own ideas, and your own voice, what do you think about that one?
It's a great question. It's one of these things that we've got to answer, right? So in the art curator example, what if the art creator used AI to pick all the pieces?
Not yet.
But they approved it. So how much did the art creator do?
I was talking about a traditional, but pre-AI. But we could bring it back to AI. Yeah, but yeah, you're right.
I want to bring that.
Yeah, that's a great example.
I want to bring that example into the future.
Yeah.
Because that's the future we're in, right?
Yes.
And so when someone is writing something to you, that's why I kind of picked on the academic integrity question.
Yeah.
Is that, do you have to make that announcement to someone or not? Like, and I think that's where as we kind of sort through that gray area, and when we start to understand what is appropriate to cite, what is not, because even though I might not expect my peer, even though I might not expect my peer to tell me, I do expect them to have reviewed it.
Yeah.
But so, that expectation is not widely known yet.
The podcast that I hosted last, Vicky Davis, Cool Cat Vicky Davis, I interviewed her. She has a set of classroom rules. And she tells her students, well, first of all, they need to have explicit permission for that assignment and for the tool for that assignment. Then they need to include the link so she can supervise how they used it.
Yeah.
And then if you want to take it a step further, you can add like a reflection and they can describe how they used AI. But do you think that would be okay?
I think that that's an excellent use case of someone that's taken the time to think through it carefully. But I have another use case for you also. And yes, I do think that that's a good way to approach it. I know schools that are starting to, on the business side, that are starting to refine their educational programs so that they're teaching the kids to solve problems with prompts.
Mm.
And they'll allow them to use those prompts like almost like in an open book way on exams.
Wow.
And then carry those prompts with them.
That's amazing.
As alum.
I'd love that.
Yeah, so you're going to see a lot of those really excellent use cases where they're fully integrated into the curriculum or it's integrated into the learning process. And I love
seeing process over product. Process over product.
So I love seeing those types of examples. And I do think that they are legitimate, particularly now where there is not yet a standard affirmed.
We could wrap it up soon, but I just want to know what skills are important that we teach students and teachers, like now more than ever.
So learning how to detect hallucinations is a critical skill for students, teachers, and staff. I think everyone needs to understand that. We're more used to detecting hallucinations from humans, even though humans hallucinate all the time. Now is the time to learn that skill. I think for teachers, learning how cheating occurs and what that process looks like. So being able to go online, find the right type of plagiarism aversion, detection aversion prompt, give it some paragraphs of your own writing and watching it generate text in your own language where it may be difficult for you to differentiate your own text from the AI. So learning those skills, the skills of cheating is kind of one dynamic area to look at. And being able to understand how to communicate about it is important so that, you know, you're in a role, especially if you're in a teacher role, we're going to have new conversations around what digital citizenship actually looks like. So having our teachers understand, adopt, absorb, and then teach is really critical at this point.
Yeah, it's incredibly important. I made the Passport to Success with the 10 stamps, and that's like a stamp because it's one of the 10 things I think is incredibly important, like a top 10 skill.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know, is there anything else you want to touch on before I ask you the final few questions?
You know, I would say it's a rapidly changing environment. I wouldn't get nervous by that. Don't allow your fears to, you know, pull you away from what learning needs to occur right now. We are going to learn through exercise. We're going to learn through interaction. You know, even recently, there was some research coming out around how these empathy prompts are very, they will help the AI perform substantially better. So for example, you can tell it, this task is really important to my career, and it will improve its process. You tell it, take a deep breath, slow down, and show your work. The AI will improve its process. So being able to take the time and those sleepless nights, as Ethan Mollick says, to move into that that new world is really important for folks. So I just want to make sure that people don't get afraid and step away.
That's what my whole mission and purpose right now is to help people not feel scared and overwhelmed, and to help like demystify what this means, because it's an incredibly exciting time. And I feel like with any disruption, there's always a little anxiety that comes with it. If we can find the good in it, you know what's funny? I had thought that when the pandemic happened, it's horrible. It was a horrible time for so many people. When that happened, it's like all the things I had been trying to teach people forever about ed tech, and now it was like happening. And it was so exciting for me in professionally, not for the world. But then we all just went back to the way things were. And I felt like with this, I was like, this is going to hopefully be the catalyst that forces us to, I'm not even talking about going in the future, to force us to where we should be today, right now in 2023.
It's a great point. And I was doing some PD this year, this September, for some schools. And one of the most salient points that I heard was the teachers told me that they felt like this was COVID 2.0 for them.
Yeah, they do.
They felt overwhelmed. There's no policy and process technology. The students are overrunning them. They really didn't know what to do. And it had that same feeling, that moment for them. So I agree with you. I do hope that the
parts stick. I think it's different though, because once they try it, like you said, and they write their lesson plan or whatever, they're going to have that light bulb moment. Once they have that moment, that aha moment, they're like, oh wow, this is actually going to save me so much time and make my life so much easier. And until they get there, then they're going to feel relieved.
That's right. Yeah. And we're going to see people get there very fast.
Yeah. It's kind of exciting. So I always have a prompt from the previous guest. So we thought of one for the next guest, but here's your prompt from the previous guest.
What is your most radical vision of what the future holds?
So I think, you know, Satya hit on this in his keynote around...
That I missed.
That you'll get to.
I know.
About how everyone might actually be able to have their own doctor, and everyone might be able to have their own educator. I think that we're closer than we think to that future.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like the most radical future I can think of, is where you have access to every type of expert that you need, a qualified expert, and that we are moving away from scarcity as the primary mode of operation, as the way that we think of things. And so being able to get there sooner than later, both from an environmental standpoint as well as from an educational standpoint and a healthcare standpoint, that will change the world, and it will change humanity. It will change how we see each other. It will change how people are able to dialogue with each other, and even how they're able to fight with each other.
Right.
You know, fighting doesn't have to always end up in war.
Yeah.
And I hope that these tools will enable us to have that level of enlightenment and that level of insight down to every person.
Oh, also speaking about that, because some of these countries are not as technologically advanced as us, so they might not even have the technology, if they're going to have a war, to have the proper technology to use AI in the right way. So that goes back to the digital divide right there.
It does. And, you know, I lived through that, the 1-to-1 or 2-to-1, you know, ideas and philosophy around getting a computer into the hand of every child. And there are a lot of challenges with that from a cost perspective, from a supply chain perspective, just everything.
Yeah.
And I was deeply a part of one of those for a very large system.
Yeah.
I think getting a smart device that is safe into the hands of every person is actually feasible.
What about in Africa?
Even in Africa, I believe deploying internet, whether it's through satellite and other types of tools, deploying those types of cell phones, I do believe that that is possible. I do believe that...
Like in tribes in Africa.
I think it'll be extraordinarily difficult. I would never say that it wouldn't be. It could be verging on impossible. But I do think it's possible.
I love that. I can't wait for that world. When do you think that will happen?
I don't know, but I hope sooner rather than later.
Me too.
You know, this is, Alana, this is, I look back 10, 12 years ago when we were doing studies on behalf of the health department, and New York City's health department is one of the leading in the world.
Yeah.
And we were looking at cell phone use with kids and kids in poverty. And we found that in this country that smartphone use was ubiquitous even then.
I know. That's what's so wild.
I know. So if we can find a way here, we can find a way everywhere. But that was 10 plus years ago.
I know.
So my sense here is that it actually is not only technologically feasible, but economically feasible to do it if we want it.
I think we should want that.
Yes, I agree.
I just want to say thank you so much for joining me here today. I know this was a last minute thing, and thank you so much for your amazing keynote. We're looking forward to seeing all the things that come from Microsoft and learning from you. So where can people find you? And also, where should they go to learn about all the things from Microsoft?
So I'm on LinkedIn, and you can certainly reach me there. I'll probably be posting more as AI now starts to evolve. Most organizations have their own account teams, so they should look towards their account teams. We also have something called MS Learn, which has a lot of free learning materials online. So that's where I would go. I would go to MS Learn. Again, follow some of the Microsoft personalities on LinkedIn.
Like, who do you recommend?
I mean, you'll see them followed on my LinkedIn, but you can certainly follow Satya. You can follow some of his direct reports. Brad Smith, by the way, is excellent to follow, particularly on responsible AI. Mm-hmm. He leads our responsible AI division. So for our administrators, focus in on what Brad Smith is doing.
What about the teachers? Where should they go?
So I would say MS Learn is the best place for them. You'll see the skill ups there. Also, you'll see a lot of community members posting on LinkedIn as it relates to high quality content in terms of prompts and what people are doing with AI. Ethan Malik has great prompts on what he's doing with AI for education. So I would say once you follow a handful, you're going to find them all pretty quickly.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. Any last comments before we end?
Congrats on your book and also your excellent presentation. Thank you for doing the podcast today.
Thank you for joining us.
And also for advocating. I think it's easy. You know, I've been in many rooms where I think folks will say, don't worry, AI will never come for your job, or, you know, the humans are going to be here forever. And you'll see rooms of people clap. And because they have a feeling like they need that to be the case. And, you know, I would just say, for anyone, don't be afraid. Dive in. That's what will help make this more responsible. It will help us extract the right use cases. So I'm looking forward to seeing what the community creates with this.
Me too.
Thank you for today, Alana.
You're welcome.
Our next episode features the E-Twins live at Nicegate. And our future episodes include Matt Miller, Ken Shelton, Monica Burns, Holly Clark, and more. Wishing everyone a happy holidays and a wonderful new year. Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Generative Age, powered by Nicegate. For a deeper dive, check out my new book titled, How'd You Guess? The Generative Age, now available on Amazon.
Our journey may pause here, but the conversation doesn't need to end.
Stay connected and informed by following me on social media at Alana Winnick and subscribing to my newsletter, all conveniently accessible on my website, alanawinnick.com.
Don't just listen, be a part of it. With your free Nicegate membership, you can join these live discussions, enroll in our free Generative Age Nicegate community, where you can share resources, ask questions, and collaborate with like-minded colleagues. If you enjoyed this podcast, consider leaving a review and telling a colleague or a friend.
We've got so much more in store, so be sure to join us next time for another exciting conversation. Until then, keep learning and keep growing in the generative age.